This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
So, Alice, before we start recording, may I invite you to the Glasgow-based Willy's Chocolate Experience? That's chocolate with one O. I've got some marketing bump here to kind of
yes,
entice
please.
You. It promises enchurining entertainment, cat gacketing, live performances, Karchi tons, Exarsadre lollipops, and a paradise of sweet teats.
I love the paradise. I mean, I think my favorite is the Karchi tons.
Karchi tons.
Oh, Jesus.
Unfortunately, I do believe this has been shut down. Either voluntarily or by the authorities. It's one of those like promised fantasy lands for children that's actually just an empty warehouse with some polyester lollipops hanging off the walls. Or was
that's my regular Saturday night.
I really want to know like the story behind the website, because it's like AI generated, but even worse than what we know AI generation is capable of. These aren't words.
Well, it doesn't matter if you're marketing it to children, because they can't read. Welcome, listener, to this Series 3, Episode 8. I'm taking a punt on 8. I am fairly sure it's 8. I'm confident. I'm 90% sure it's Episode 8 this week.
We'll go with 8.
The Electronic Wireless Show, Rock, Paper, Shotguns, PC Gaming Podcast, and the only podcast you need, in my opinion, which is that of Alice Bell. I'm joined this week by James Archer. Hello, Jams.
Hello.
How are things? You didn't get to go to the, the Willy's Chocolate Experience.
You're the one who was in Scotland recently.
I was in Aberdeen this weekend, just gone for it was called Granite Noir. It was a book festival, a crime book festival in Aberdeen. I'd never been to Aberdeen before. It was quite lovely.
Oh, nice.
It's furthest north I've ever been, but it was very sunny, so I got good weather for it, I think. But I was texting. Do you know, like, when a games journo goes to like a fan event and they're sort of like reporting on it, like they're a naturalist, like they're fucking Attenborough, you know. I was doing that, but like, I was texting Graham, RPS in peace, because he is from Scotland. He's from, I think, just outside Glasgow, actually. And I was like, Graham, what is... Because like, I've been to Scotland before, but I've been to Edinburgh, which is mostly full of English people. So I was like, Graham, I got a swag bag and it had like tatty scones and haggis flavoured crisps in it. What is happening? Like, I didn't realise Scotland was like this Scottish. I thought that was just for tourists. But I saw people in like kilts cutting about and like... And I was like, Scottish people do actually say I like all the time.
Yeah.
And he was like, what are you talking about? Like, obviously.
I went to Scotland for the first time in December last year, and I was also struck by the Scottishness of it. Because I don't know, I live in London. Because I went to Glasgow and Edinburgh, I kind of thought they'd just be like a bit, you know, like London but northern. But, you know, the overwhelming majority, I think, are actual proper Scots. So,
well, I know we sound like twats discussing this, but like I assumed that like a lot of the more Scottish stuff that we think of as being very Scottish is mostly played up for like Americans that think they're Scottish, and this may be influenced by my experience of living in like a tourist town in Ireland, where like right. every time an American turns up and is like, "Oh my God, was this woman on the Titanic? Were they the O'Briens from you know, Kerry, because that's my family," and then whoever it is will be like, "It is, yeah, yeah, it's definitely your ancestors." That'll be £30, you know. Like, so I assumed it was like that, but Scottish people are just delightful. I had a lovely time. Everyone was very friendly, and also I know I'm really preambling here before we start talking about anything, but I saw an incredible sugar daddy situation while I was there.
A sugar daddy situation.
Yes, it was so good, because I am trying to get better at like going out by myself, you know, when you don't have someone to like go for dinner with or whatever.
Yeah,
go out and have a nice dinner by yourself kind of thing, for whatever reason. This was a dinner, this was lunch. I went to the shopping center, I needed to get some stuff for my phone, and there's one Apple store in all of Ireland, and it is not in the city where their European headquarters are. It's in Dublin. So I was like, Aberdeen has an Apple store, I will go and get whatever I need. And then I had like an hour before the panel I was on. So I was like, oh, I've got to get lunch in the shopping center. So I went into a Prezzo at lunchtime on a Friday. And there was an older gentleman dressed all in grey with like grey Converse and like pulled up grey socks and a grey turtleneck. And they were in a little booth. It was him and a much younger lady. So she was like my age and he was like 60. So it wasn't like terrifying like 19-year-old with it situation. Yeah. It was like, everyone's getting something out of this. They're all adults. It's fine. But it was very funny because like they were sat in the booth and they were doing that thing where, you know, instead of sitting opposite your date, you sit next to them, and he had his hand on her leg and stuff. But they were like acting like they were in the fucking Ritz or something. Like they were sending food back. They were asking for ice for their Pinot Grigio. They were like they made a point of saying they were like regulars at this fucking shopping center Prezzo in Aberdeen, because they were like, the food last week was really great, but it wasn't. And I was just like, wow, I mean, live your dreams, hun. She's found a man that will buy her whatever she wants. It's
at Prezzo,
exactly. Although, in fairness to them, it was the worst plate of pasta I've had in my life, so maybe I should have sent the food back as well, but it was great. I was texting all my friends about it, and I had to leave. She got a phone call. Exactly, yeah. She got a phone call that was like a drama phone call. She was like, "I didn't say that. That's a lie." And like started kicking off. But like, I had to go. I couldn't hang around. Like, I'd already paid, so I couldn't like stand there anymore. Otherwise, it would just be really obvious that I was just listening. Anyway, I do recommend Aberdeen. It's lovely. This has no bearing on anything that we're talking about today. How are you, James? You all right?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. I got I have a bit of a toothache, actually.
Oh no!
And I was looking at my dentistry options, and like you can't get an NHS dentist around here. Like it takes months. So I looked at like do I have like dental benefits for my employment? And it turns out I waived them last year.
Why?
Because you have to pay for it. That's not a benefit. That's losing money. But yeah, no, it is like it is subsidized dental care. So I conveniently we are currently in the signing up phase for this year's company benefits. So I signed up. Dental coverage now, but it doesn't kick in until like I think the 1st of April. So I'm currently, I'm in a situation I think a lot of Americans are, where they think kind of like, can I just like live with the pain rather than pay to make it go away?
I get a toothache whenever I have a stuffed nose.
Really?
My molars start hurting at the back. I've been to the dentist before about it, and she was like, "You fool, just blow your nose." Oh God, none of this is about Easter eggs. It's not even Easter. How are we going to segue this, James?
Easter's in April, right?
Yeah.
So my... I'll be able to go to the dentist in April, which is when Easter is. And you know what else you get in Easter? That was the most disapproving sinus noise I've ever heard.
Nah, it was good. I've got a sore throat. I thought I had COVID again because I was around people, obviously, this weekend. Ooh. If I got COVID again, that would be six times. I'm cooking my brain. It's not good. But in the news this week was a kind of slightly cryptic Miyazaki sort of tease about Elden Ring, the Souls-like game from From Software. New DLC is out soon. The Shadow of the Erd Tree?
That's it.
I've surprised my own self remembering that. So, in an interview with Ian Games Network, the director said the devs are always surprised and delighted by how much the players do discover and how much these communities work to uncover these secrets. IGN say, in their own words, that Miyazaki said he doesn't think there's anything that hasn't been discovered by now. And then, somewhat contradictorily, he suggested maybe there was something. For me personally, there is a small element that I feel has not yet been discovered. So whether that's up to user interpretation or up to just further investigation and playing, that's something I'm looking forward to, he added. I think it's a question of when and not if, but there may be something small still missing. So first of all, do you believe him, James?
When I saw the headlines about this, I thought it'd be like a meaty secret, of which, to my understanding, Elden Ring has many. Like it's an unusually vast and diverse range of like secret stuff in that game. I don't know if it's just like the translation, but the way he described it there made it sound like it is a very, very minor thing. Like maybe, I don't know, something boring like how certain stats multiply with something, certain weapon interactions. I don't know. I hope it is big, because that'd be neat. Even though
it doesn't yet.
Yeah. I don't ordinarily like it when developers do this like nudge and wink thing at secrets, because if you know something's there, it naturally becomes less of a secret.
Well, that's why I'm a bit like, I don't know if I believe him, because it sounds like, oh, maybe there's something there. Wink, maybe there isn't.
You think it's a bit of myth-making?
Yeah, basically.
Maybe.
Do you know?
Yeah. Although
And then in like a few weeks' time, someone on Reddit will be like, I think I found what Miyazaki was talking about. It's this plant or whatever. And he can just pick one of the many things and be like, yeah. And he can just, he'll pick one and be like, yeah, it was that. Well done. Do you know?
Yeah. Or he's double bluffing.
Ooh.
I don't want to say would he care about that? But developers do care about this stuff. Was it Batman Arkham Asylum had a secret room somewhere that I think Rocksteady basically got bored of waiting for people to find. So after a few months, they just announced it existed on a podcast.
I didn't know they did that. I knew about the secret, because that's the room that has like plans for Arkham City, right? Which is like teasing the next game.
Yeah, it's cool contents, but maybe like, I think, would it have been cooler if they just waited for it to, you know, come out naturally, and then maybe Arkham City would already be out by that point, and then there would have been a much bigger, you know, finger pointing, oh, kind of moment.
Yeah, I agree. Because it makes it sound like that they built that secret room as like part of their marketing plan in that case, and they needed it to be discovered at like a certain point. I didn't know they announced it on a podcast. That's very funny. That's great. I do agree with him that like the community around the FromSoft games are amazing in terms of, because those games are so big and like weird, so much of the story is just hidden in like item descriptions or whatever.
Yeah.
So they really have to put the work in. And fair play to them for that. But yeah, I'm not entirely sure I believe that he's talking about anything specific, and he's maybe just myth-making. I don't know. Maybe that's uncharitable of me. I apologize, Miyazaki. But I don't know. I might start doing that with my books. Just be like, there's something someone hasn't worked out. And then just, and just see what people come up with.
What are some other good secrets in games?
Well, I was thinking, do you know what the first ever Easter egg was, James?
No, I don't. Do you like
it? So, it was from the 1980 video game Adventure for the Atari 2600, 2600. How do you say it? The Atari 2600.
I say 2600 for some reason. That's not how I'd normally pronounce the number 2600, but I'd definitely say 2600 in relation to that specific
Maybe it
game
is
console.
The 2600. Hmm. It's like how Americans say NES and SNES, and we say SNES.
SNES, yeah. SNES is just more
I think
fun
SNES
to say.
Is more. Yeah. More fun! Yes, exactly. This game was programmed by the employee Warren Robinette, and at the time Atari did not include programmers' names in the game credits, according to Wikipedia, both to prevent competitors from poaching its developers, as well as to deny developers a means to bargain with management of the new owners.
They're keeping their staff secret.
Basically, yeah. And so Robinette secretly programmed the message created by Warren Robinette to appear if a player moves their avatar over a specific pixel, which is dubbed the grey dot, during a certain part of the game and enters a previously forbidden part of the map where you can see the message. He didn't tell them he'd done this, and then he left Atari. Shortly after his departure, it was discovered by a player, and they wanted initially Atari to remove the message and re-release the game, but this would cost too much money, so they just left it.
People got mad about that.
Atari got mad about it.
Atari got mad.
Atari got mad.
I thought you meant like the player who discovered it got mad.
No, I wouldn't put it past players.
This is breaking my immersion.
Instead, Steve Wright, the director of software development in the Atari Consumer Division, suggested they keep the message and, in fact, encourage the inclusion of such messages in future games, describing them as Easter eggs for consumers to find. Imagine, like, credits as Easter eggs.
Yeah.
Jeez. Come on.
Fair play to Warren Robinette, though. Well, Warren Robinette.
I know, I struggle with saying it as well.
Anti-work icon.
There are some that I've seen that I like. The Witcher 2 has one that I liked, which is you in a certain part of the castle. It's very early on, but you walk past like a what do you call it? Cart full of hay, but it's been like obliterated, and then there's like it's all kind of crushed and smashed, and then there's just like the body of a dead assassin from Assassin's Creed.
All right. I know that one.
I like that one. Another one I really like is in Day of the Tentacle, which is one of my favourite games, 1993 Lucasfilm, LucasArts. You can play the full original Maniac Mansion game from the 80s just by, like, it's just on a computer in a character's room.
That's neat.
And you just you play like a whole other game in this game, which I think is pretty cool. Do you have any favourites?
Yeah, so one of my old favourites is not a PC game, but in the first few Ratchet and Clank games, there's this thing called the Insomniac Museum, obviously named after developers Insomniac, which was filled with like concept art and scrapped material and developer commentary. And it was always like a physical place that you had to find, and then once you were there, that's how you viewed everything. It was literally a museum that you could run around and poke around in. But it was always like a physical place that you had to find, and the way to do that was normally, a bit Easter egg-y. Like you had to either like stand in a certain place at a certain time of day, or like set your PS2 clock to be that time just before you load in. I like that stuff not just for the secrecy, but also like the sheer wealth of interesting stuff that you get by unearthing the secret. And then at the opposite end of that, I really like extremely small and petty secrets. So Resident Evil 4, the original one, has a hidden cardboard cutout of a man. I don't know who he is. He's just a man in like a jacket and a scarf. A cardboard cutout of him that's placed so far outside the playable area of the game that you need the best like sniper rifle scope and to turn your screen brightness up just to like vaguely make out his outline. And even then, it's only by looking through this one crack in one random rock. It's so like pointless and petty, but I love it for that reason. There's no good reason for it exists, but they do it anyway. And then it's also cool when games have secrets that sort of rely on its players to build a myth around it. Even if it's not like necessarily intended as an Easter egg. You see a lot of this stuff in speedrunning, I think, where someone finds, I don't know, like a section of wall that you can shimmy through, and then that gets collectively named something like the Steve Cut because someone called Steve found it. But there's a really good example in Super Mario 64 known as the unkillable Goomba. And basically, there's a single Goomba in the final level of Super Mario 64 that spawns right at the bottom of the map. And because that's considered out of bounds, it dies almost instantly. And the reason it's called the unkillable Goomba, despite dying very quickly, is that for over a decade, people have been trying and failing to get down to the bottom of the map and kill it themselves.
Oh my
god. Before the game does a job for them. I think that's great because that has both the investigative aspect that someone had to actually go and find this Goomba in the first place, and actually people only discovered it because someone found out that Goombas always spawn in a little triangle of three, and someone noticed that on like the actual platform in this level that there's only two Goombas, so it was like, where's a third Goomba? There's supposed to be a third Goomba and it's down there. So it has both that aspect and also the incredibly human desire to try and conquer the impossible.
That's like the grannies who broke through the walls in Red Dead Redemption Online. We have a news post about it. I don't know if you... There's a really short documentary, I think it's about 15 minutes, that's about all the weird shit they found, like, out of bounds, managing to break out of the map, like these weird pyramids and, like, water that's, like, 2D kind of you can sort of float in. It's amazing.
A lot of that to me is like more interesting than that actual like Easter eggs that people have designed. It's a glimpse behind the curtain.
Well, they patched it out in the end, so you can't get there anymore. So they closed the curtain because you're not meant to. Yeah, which I always think is a shame. There's little things as well. I the sort of set dressing ones. Like I think you could find like a crashed like alien spaceship in I want to say Red Dead Redemption 2. I think it's 2. That's supposed to be like a Superman reference. I think I'm pretty sure it's Red Dead Redemption. It's a Rockstar game anyway. or like. In one of the Fallouts, you can find like a fridge with like a body with a fedora.
Oh yeah,
like an Indiana Jones hat as a reference to the Crystal Skull bit where he finds himself at the nuclear testing site and gets in a fridge. Like, cool. I love that stuff. Do you think like it's now like a fit like? You know, Easter eggs aren't kind of that hidden anymore because people want people to find, like the Arkham Asylum thing. Do you think it's like a tick box thing, like you put in an Easter egg kind of thing now?
I don't know. I think it probably varies on a case by case basis. I think some people probably do put something in with a view to, I don't know, it being screenshotted and then shared about like, oh, look at this cool thing in game that's available now. I think a lot of it is, maybe more personal stuff put in by individual developers who maybe don't have the backing.
That's the better stuff, I think.
Yeah, those things are harder to find. I guess it's...
Yeah.
But then also, like, maybe people aren't as inclined to do that anymore because it's so much easier to patch games nowadays, and if someone finds something that isn't, like... a studio approved Easter egg, then
unsanctioned.
Unsanctioned Easter egg. Then that could be like patched out in short order, unlike Warren.
You nearly got it.
I can't get Rubes Pierre out of my head, and I know that's not it.
That would be great. Robinette.
Robinette, there we go. Rubes Pierre, fucking hell.
Yeah, that's very true. I don't know if like it, because as well, the other thing is that like you've got so much actual work that you've got to do when you're making a game now. Like if you're crunching, do you have time to like do something whimsical just for yourself?
Yeah. Oh, I do. I really like the running joke of asking Alan to put something in. Do you know? It was originally like one of the Hitman games. There was a missing item description where Io had accidentally left in the message like, "Alan, please write something," or like, "Alan, please add description." And then that became like a thing where unrelated developers to Hitman started putting these little Easter eggs in the games where it says like, "Alan, please add this texture," "Alan, please write blurb."
That's good. I like that. That's like a Wilhelm scream.
I assume that's a running joke, and there isn't just this one particularly incompetent person called Alan who has done a lot of job hopping throughout game studios.
You never know. I mean, everyone's job hopping these days, though, aren't they? Through no fault of their own.
Yeah.
good stuff. I mean, we'll see with the Miyazaki's comments if there is something in Elden Ring that has yet to be found and what it is. Someone I follow on Twitter is doing a very funny run. I'll find a link to it if I can. In Elden Ring, where they've made like a tank, like high damage, huge sword that does like, you know, bosses in a few hits. You just have to avoid getting hit yourself. I think he's called it the bonk build because you just bonk. I'll try and find a link to that. It's very good. If you have an inkling as to what you think the Elden Ring secret might be, then get in touch. You can email us podcast@rockpapershotgun.com. Let's move on now to talk about games what we have been playing this week.
I have been playing Nightingale, and I do not like it.
No!
So this is a Gaslamp fantasy survival crafting game.
Yeah.
From Inflection Games, who were founded by Aaron Flynn, who was previously general manager of BioWare. It's weird because some parts of it feel like they were made by people with enormous creative talent, and some parts feel like they were made by someone who's never played a video game before.
Oh my goodness, that's so interesting, though.
Like the styling of it is really very well realized and very distinct, like especially among survival games. So it has this like really strong Victorian Britain crossed with the works of C.S. Yeah. Lewis vibe. And the general fiction of it is quite strong. Basically, it's still in the days of mustaches and hoop skirts, but also fae exist, and interdimensional travel is not considered that big of a deal. That then ties into what is a very cool twist on survival games, in that you have to travel between realms to find all the stuff you need, as opposed to it all being in one fixed space. And you can like set and later change the rules of each realm, each reality, kind of by playing these magic cards. So when you go through a portal, you can choose for it to be like either a very abundant forest or maybe a desert that doesn't have many resources but does have more fey ruins that you can raid for better loot. And there are these things called realmic transmuters, I think they're called, where you can activate another card within a realm and that can instantly change the weather or plunge it into darkness and stuff like that.
That's fun.
And that's all great. But the actual survival crafting stuff is so tedious. It is the absolute slowest, most granular, most opaque rendition of the chop trees, gather pelts, refine ingots formula that I think I've ever played, personally.
Oh, dear.
Like, everything you need to do, need to craft, I suppose, seems to have like five preceding steps that you need to before you can actually start. And most of those either involve watching a load of very sluggish gathering animations or sitting around and waiting while a timer ticks down over the crafting bench. So And like the more stuff you build, like the longer that timer is. So
yeah.
So if you want to cook like 10 slabs of meat at once, you're going to be staring at a stove for really more than you should. I know the appeal of these games is that like these style of games is that you essentially build yourself up with your own two hands.
And it's, you know, bootstraps, isn't it?
Satisfying. Yeah, but I never get excited about finishing something because the process to get there is just so boring. Oh, it is proper like to make bread from scratch, you must first create the universe.
Thinking about it, because I was like, oh, I like the look of this. I like the Rococo Mr. Tumnus. Well, it's voiced by Mark Warren, I believe, who was in the TV adaptation of Jonathan Nowell and Mr. Strange as a Fae King, which is pretty good casting. I don't like survival games, but I do like flashy Rococo fantasy nonsense. And I would have thought that people who do like survival games do not particularly like flashy Rococo survival nonsense, gaslight fantasy nonsense. So, it just seems like, you know, they like griefing each other with bows and arrows in Ark or whatever. They don't like, you know, fabulous gilded bunny rabbits and portals and things and flying umbrellas and such like. So it just seems like a slight kind of mismatch there.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I do think like the fantasy stuff is the strongest aspect, like by far.
Mm.
And the times I've enjoyed Nightingale most are when basically I've ignored all the crafting stuff and just gone adventuring. And there is quite a nice sense of going forth and then traveling between like new realms and finding these lairs that themselves contain portals. And you don't know where the portal goes, but you throw yourself in anyway. And ultimately survival crafting games are about progression, but that adventuring never feels as integral to that progression as chopping wood and mining ore does.
Yeah, so they should have made maybe a slightly different kind of game, because the concept really does sound fun.
Yeah, it doesn't really try to spice up those processes or like tie them into more interesting exploits beyond having this nice gaslight fantasy aesthetic. I was actually playing a little bit of Sons of the Forest yesterday, and I think that does a better job because it kind of tie if you want like a specific item, then it's almost like a little mini mission to go get that item, which can take you, you know, into a cannibal lair or having to swim out to sea amongst a load of sharks.
And that's
still tied into like the gear progression system. And I don't think, Nightingale doesn't have that sense, doesn't, you know, tie in the sense of adventuring as much, except there are some, like, places you have to raid in order to unlock the ability to create new cards. But, I don't know, I don't think it rewards adventuring as strongly as it should.
Yeah. That's a shame. I would say it's a shame. I was sort of rooting for it, I suppose, but I'm not playing it. So. But Alice, I pointed out, like, your game doesn't get to be a success just because you used to work at BioWare. Like, you still have to make a game that people want to play. So,
Apparently, some things I said in a preview we did of Nightingale made Aaron Flynn quite cross at me.
Well, I mean, who was right? You know,
it's not, I don't know.
I love Aaron Flynn's work, but, you know, perhaps if they had listened to you, James, more people would be playing the game. Unfortunately, the hit of the moment is Balatro. Have you played any Balatro? Because I haven't played any Balatro.
I have not played any Balatro. I had my finger literally hovering over the buy button on Steam because it's, to me, it's like it's very similar to like Baldur's Gate 3 situation where everyone loves it, so like it must surely be good. But I look at it, I just think this is not my thing at all.
Yes, 100%. I think neither of us are very it's not like I'm anti deck builder, but I don't enjoy them.
Yeah, like this
personally.
There's not much like This is, again, like, this is me personally, but there's not much, like, tactile interaction or, like, maybe a sense of doing things in a deck builder. It is, like, kind of all maths. Apparently Bellaccio has, like, Edwin was saying has a really nice, like, very very satisfying thing where you unlock new cards and you get to, like, unwrap them from the shiny wrapping, and that's, you know, nice and crunchy and satisfying. But I don't think that can sustain me for
hours. Every time I say, oh, I don't really, I feel like I'm physically incapable of enjoying deck builders. Like, my brain chemistry just does not allow for it. But every time I say I don't like deck builders, some prick on RPS's Slack is like one of my valued colleagues is always like, oh no, this one's really good, it's really juicy, oh, big number go up, whatever. And they're always fucking lying. Like, no deck builder is good. Even the only one that I sort of got on with a bit was Inscryption, and that's because that's mostly not a deck builder, and I wasn't very good at the deck building bits, so that really was a barrier to me enjoying the game.
I got a bit of FOMO with Inscryption, to be honest. My reaction to yours is like kind of similar. Like, I know I won't like it, but also I'm a bit sad that I won't like it, because everyone's having so much fun.
Oh, I know. All them going on about fucking Slay the Spire. Stop it. Stop enjoying it in front of me.
Stop talking about Slay the Spire.
Yeah, everyone stop talking about Slay the Spire now, please. Thank you. You've had your fun.
What? What have you been playing, Alice?
Speaking of having fun, I have been playing since yesterday. The DLC, we spoke about it last week, the Warhammer 40k Special Pack DLC for Power Wash Simulator.
Okay.
So good. It's really good. If you like Power Wash Simulator. And I think it's so good that if you like Power Wash Simulator but you don't really know much about Warhammer 40k, I think it can make you interested in Warhammer 40k.
Really?
Because it's so, like, yeah, because it's very show, don't tell. And it has quite a light touch, and it renders these huge, like, war machines, these massive mechs and these dropships and stuff in this very kind of larger-than-life world. And normally, obviously, you can only, like, see them at a distance, you know, quite small. Even the miniatures are little, right? I mean, they're miniatures. So seeing them, like, big and kind of to a scale, you can walk around them and jump on them and climb around them and stuff, makes them really impressive. And it also, it doesn't really explain all the stuff. So you play like a tech priest, like an engine seer, I think they're called. So you're like a little mechanic, basically, for this sort of quasi-religious, fanatical empire of space marines. And your job is to clean these battle, you know, machines.
Mm.
And it's all in context in like a huge kind of cathedral like vaulted space, and you can look out the window and see Mars and stuff. It's great. And you will be cleaning something off, and it will be like one of those little wax seals with a bit of paper, and it'll just say like purifying seal as you're cleaning it, you know, on your little HUD. And you're like, what's a purifying seal? Why has it got like six of them strapped to this shield? Or like you clean something called a dreadnought, which is a sort of super space RoboCop, right? So it's got like a guy in there.
It's kind of like a big mech crossed with a life support machine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But if you don't know anything about that, you're cleaning it and you're like, what? Why am I cleaning a sarcophagus on this big machine? And then you're like, why is there a viewing window in the sarcophagus, man? Like, what? You know, so I think it's really good at that, at just making it seem really interesting and making the lore seem really cool, divorced from, like, you know, going to a shop with grey carpet full of, in my experience, very gatekeeper-y dudes with ponytails. It makes it kind of really fun and interesting, and, like, it's made me want to read, like, some of the books from the Black Library and stuff Don't nobody tell Nate. He'll text me. Too excited.
I'm glad they've kind of kept the sense of scale.
Yeah.
Despite being miniatures, that is one of the, I guess, defining traits of 40K is that everything is just unfathomably huge.
Yeah. This is like 9 meter tall, you know, huge paladin knight thing that's got like a giant, you can like stand on the chainsaw sword on one arm while you're hosing down its shoulder kind of thing. It's really good. My one sort of slight disappointment, I haven't done all of it so far, I've done quite a lot of the levels, but nothing has moved yet. So like in the some of the levels and in like some of the, say, the Back to the Future DLC or the Final Fantasy special pack, the Midgard special pack, you could press a button and like open up a bit of one of the mechs or like move the gun arm up and down to better get at some of the bits to clean it. I haven't been able to do that yet, which is disappointing.
There hasn't been a space marine who marches in through a door and demands that you hose him down.
No, not yet. It could happen. You do, it's really good, you get like kind of passive-aggressive bitchy texts basically from a co-worker. So you get like very light, you know, lore context, heavily redacted as if you're getting like, you know, letters from the front about what you're cleaning and why and where it's been and stuff, like, you know, redacted planet. But you also get messages from a peer, essentially like another tech priest, who when you start is like your superior, but you quickly get kind of promoted and you get given like the cooler jobs and like the more honorable, you know, you're cleaning like a dreadnought and whatever, and he starts sending you like passive aggressive messages being like, once again you have the honor of cleaning a, you know, the knight paladin, whereas I am stuck hosing down the barrels of crud or whatever, and then gets cross or will say like, still 19.98% to be cleaned, are you losing your touch and stuff, perhaps I should pray with ever fervor for you to, you know, so that's fun as well. So it's still got the power wash sim sense of humor as well. So I really enjoy it. If you like Power Wash Sim, definitely check it out. If you like Warhammer 40k, I would say check it out. I don't know if you'd like Power Wash Sim, but Power Wash Sim's very good. There you go.
Yeah. How do you rate it amongst the other Power Wash Sim crossover DLCs?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it is one of my favourites. I maybe liked the Back to the Future one a bit more, just because I have more nostalgia to that. I'm like, Back to the Future. This is very good, and the machines are very impressive just to see them, and the kind of attention to detail with, you know, the power washer you have is called the Aquasantica Aquabus, and it makes a slightly different noise and stuff than the main game one, things like that. It's very good. I try to think of playing anything else this week. I must have done, but Power Wash Sim. Let me look at my Steam. What have I been playing? Yeah, Power Wash Sim. Oh god, I played 6 hours last night. Jeez.
Yeesh.
I know. I've been playing that, and I've been playing Cobalt Core for our game club, which is a roguelike deck builder, and I'm currently writing an article trying to explain why I don't like it, because it's a deck builder, but it's not no fault of Cobalt Core.
So it's not an issue with Cobalt Core specifically.
No, it's just because it's a roguelike deck builder that I've been forced to play. So I played about that. I've also been recommended Witch Hand by my friend Johnny. They said it was really good, but I haven't played any of it yet. But it's looks like a cute little kind of. If I open it up, it's a kind of like you're a witch and you're leading a coven, but you're doing it through like cards that you place on a board, rather than like doing the things yourself.
Sounds like a deck builder. It's not.
I don't know, but I'm going to give that a go this week. Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. But mostly power washing, obviously.
God, I can't remember the last time I played 6 hours or something straight.
I know, how university days. Is that?
I mean, just
because I got nothing on and no one to talk to. Anyway, James, it sounds like it's a good day to wear hard.
It is a good day to wear hard, and today we are returning to the sweaty-faced world of virtual reality, because Sony, makers of the PSVR 2 VR headset for the PlayStation 5, a lot of downs, they have announced that we are currently testing the ability for PSVR 2 players to access additional games on PC to offer even more game variety in addition to the PSVR 2 titles available through PS5. We hope to make the support available in 2024, so stay tuned for more updates. Basically, barring disaster, the formerly PS5 exclusive PSVR 2 will be usable in some way, shape, or form on PC. And this is an interesting one because the PSVR 2 is one of those hardware things that is pretty successful at what it is, but in other ways is maybe starting to look like a failure. So by all accounts, like the hardware is great. Like it has a, I haven't tried it, but like it's reviewed very well. It has a very high resolution like OLED display in the goggles. So good sharpness, good colors, contrast, and all that. It's apparently quite comfortable. The controllers are good. Has haptic feedback for your face, so it will shake your face when something exciting happens.
What?
Haptic feedback, like when your controller vibrates.
I know what haptic feedback is, but it vibrates your cheeks.
Yeah.
Weird. Okay.
There are already like gaming headsets with haptic feedback that vibrate, the sides of your head.
Oh, I don't like that. No, ban it.
it could very well be a good VR kit for PC. However. It is pretty expensive, not so much as the Valve Index, which I think is still £919 or something, I believe, but the PSVR 2 is about £530-ish in the UK, which I think is more than a PS5. It's also become apparent that despite launching the PSVR 2 with some quite big VR games, there's Horizon Call of the Mountain, Cities VR... it has a Resident Evil 4 remake VR version that isn't currently available for PC. So despite all that, there haven't really been many big PSVR 2 games more recently. And now Sony have also announced, this is after making the PSVR 2 announcement, they've also announced hundreds of layoffs that affect
some
of the studios that were working on VR games, including Firesprite, who co-developed Rising Call of the Mountain, they're actually being shut down entirely. So there's maybe a sense that perhaps the PSVR 2 isn't doing all that great in a business sense, and that might be why it's now coming to PC. And I don't want to say the PS5, I don't want to say like that the PS5's loss is the PC's gain, because hundreds of people have lost their jobs and that would be ghoulish. But in a strictly hardware and game sense, the fact that PSVR 2 is going to PC probably could be a good thing. Like, platform exclusivity is increasingly like an outmoded concept when, all Xbox exclusives launch day and day on PC. Sony themselves seem quite happy to port over PlayStation games, even if it is like after a few years. So it's probably good also to have competition for the Meta Quest 3, especially since that's as much of a metaverse toy as it is a gaming device, whereas the PSVR 2 is focused solely on games. I guess it's like generally good news for VR on PC as a concept. I guess we'll see, depending on how Sony's testing goes. Have you played much VR, Alice?
No, it makes me terribly sick.
Really?
Incredibly, incredibly sick. Yeah, really bad motion sickness.
Nice.
Properly can't hack it. And also, I brought this up before, but there is as yet no solution to wearing a VR headset if you wear makeup, particularly foundation.
Oh, yeah.
Although I'm not much of a foundation wearer these days, but it does leave like a little goggle mark, basically. wherever it touches your face, which is not ideal.
Yeah. This is something that concerns me a bit about like the direction of VR, because a lot of what manufacturers are doing to innovate is based more on making them bigger and fancier and capable of doing more things. I think for loads and loads of people, the main reason they don't play as much VR is because they just don't want to wear several hundred grams of scuba equipment on their face when they're playing when they're playing games.
I think ease of use would be something to concentrate on more personally.
Yeah, it is tricky, to be fair, because you have all these as with a lot of hardware, you have all these kind of contradicting desires, I suppose. So people want a VR headset that without any cables. Well, okay, so you put a battery on it. People want a VR headset that's light and portable. Well, okay, but now we've put a battery on it, so it has to weigh more.
I'm with you. Yeah.
Last year I tried out something called has quite a long name, but I hope I get this right. The HTC Vive XR Elite, I think that was it. And that was kind of like, it could be a conventional PC VR headset. They could also break down almost to just a pair of slightly chunky glasses that could still do.
Oh, okay.
They could still do very basic VR. I don't think it could play I don't think it could connect to a PC to do proper VR games. But I think that's more. Yeah, making the hardware easier to use and lighter to wear and just generally more comfortable, I think is maybe could maybe draw more people to it than just making it more powerful.
Yeah, so, I agree.
So yeah, but I don't know. This is something I'm not a massive expert on. Most of our VR coverage on RPS is done by a chap called Rick Lane, friend of RPS, who's much more knowledgeable about it than I am. I think the PSVR 2 is good on specs and has some good games. This is one thing. It'd be cool if the PSVR 2 exclusive games get ported to PC as well. That'd be nice. Mm. Wouldn't mind having a go on Call of the Mountain. Rick actually wants to play Resident Evil 4 remake on VR, so that'll be good for him as well.
Now, that is just about all we have time for this week, because we have no Nate this week, and therefore no mini game. But as with every week, we will close with recommending something that is not a video game. James, what are you recommending this week?
I'm recommending an album called Tiny Changes, A Celebration of Frightened Rabbits, The Midnight Organ Fight, or just Tiny Changes. Basically, this is a covers album, all based on songs from Frightened Rabbit's, I think, 2008 album, The Midnight Organ Fight, done by a load of different bands and artists. Okay. I've really liked this album for many, many years, but I've only just got back into listening to it, more or less daily. And it is desperately sad, not just because The Midnight Organ Fight is full of breakup songs, but because in between it being recorded and released, Scott Hutchinson, the singer of Frightened Rabbit, passed away. So it's still... there's this really... It almost unintentionally became a tribute album. It's very sad and can, I guess depending on how into Frightened Rabbit you were, it can be quite difficult to listen to maybe. But it's still that kind of beautiful sadness. A lot of these songs are absolutely gorgeous, so nicely textured and well performed, and really the production on it is fantastic as well. So if you can just power through that sadness, it is really rewarding, I think. If you just want a taste, I'd say the highlights are Daughter's cover of a song called Poke and Julian Baker's version of The Modern Leper, but there's loads of good songs on there from a load of very talented bands covering another very talented band. So yeah, it's good.
I'm going to recommend a new podcast called Here Comes the Guillotine.
Okay.
It's a comedy podcast that is the comedians Frankie Boyle, Susie McCabe and Christopher McCarthy-Boyd, who are three Glasgow comedians. It's quite dark, but like lefty, right on darkness, I guess. They have a good kind of recurring bit about how... because it's just rambling, like mate cast, like banter cast, but just very funny. And they have a recurring bit about how if he'd been born a bit later, if he was of today's generation, because he was so open-minded and sort of inquisitive and wanting to learn about the world, then Billy Connolly would have been a conspiracy theorist because he would have run into the internet really quickly. So they just occasionally will be like, Building 7, fuck off. It's really good. Really makes me laugh. I know so many people who would love this. I just think it's really great, and I absolutely recommend giving it a shot, because it's really been a good pick me up for the last few weeks. There's three episodes out now, so yeah, look, here comes the guillotine.
Nice. I used to really not like Frankie Boyle because I didn't really like the kind of like, yeah, ooh, edgy humor, but then Ricky Gervais happened and it kind of gave me some perspective.
Well, his stand-up has actually changed a lot. I have seen him live recently, and it's different to, you know, from when he became famous. And they even reference that in an episode of the podcast where they say, like, you know, people who liked your old stuff, you know, coming to you now. Like, it's still kind of dark, but it's less just, like, being offensive.
Yeah.
For being offensive's sake. It's not, like, shock comedy. So, it's, yeah, if you only knew Frankie Boyle from like 15 years ago, his style of comedy is very different now, I think.
Interesting.
I would say, yeah, so maybe give him another shot, see what you think.
Give him a fair whack.
Yeah. That, though, is really all we've got time for on this season 3, episode 8 of the Electronic Wireless Show. We talked about Easter eggs in video games with some excellent segue work from James. Thank you, James.
You are very welcome.
I'm too tired to segue, babes. thank you so much for joining us. You can, as I mentioned, email us podcast@rockpapershotgun.com. You can join the Discord. You can... What else can you do, James? Oh, you can find Rock Paper Shotgun on all of your favourite and least favourite social medias, where you can just search for Rock Paper Shotgun, will turn up. The Discord is a really fun place to hang out as well, so the link for that is in the show notes. But for all of your PC gaming needs, just go to www.rockpapershotgun.com. And until next time, you listening, I love you. Thank you. And thank you to you, James, for joining me.
Thank you too. I like listeners too, in a platonic way.